From February 10th through March 6th, join KPFK 90.7 FM for our Winter Fun Drive. As a listener-sponsored platform, we remain one of the few places on the dial where the airwaves belong to the people, not corporations. In honor of the Black History Month centennial, we're featuring the profound insights and historical recordings of the giants who shook the foundations of injustice, including James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Dr. Cornel West, and so many others from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Your contribution keeps our independent signal alive and preserves these revolutionary voices for the next generation. The number to call is 818-985-5735. Press option 2 or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org/donate. Donate today and let your voice be heard.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll examine what the latest trove of released Epstein files says about global elites networking together to further their own interests while engaging in widespread human and sex trafficking. My guest, Jeet Heer of The Nation, has analyzed the files and will share his insights. Then, as one of the world's richest men, Jeff Bezos, decimates his own newspaper, The Washington Post, media analyst Victor Picard will offer solutions for rebuilding journalism from the ashes of billionaire ownership. And finally, Ruben Torres, organizer with the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition, will share with us how the whitest state in the nation is defending itself from ICE terror. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The latest trove of Epstein files released by the United States Justice Department came many weeks after a deadline Congress had established through the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Some 3 million pages of documents published contained heavy redactions, and yet, in many cases, victims of the sordid sex trafficking ring that Epstein led were exposed. Meanwhile, the perpetrators and beneficiaries of Jeffrey Epstein's web continue to operate in public with impunity. What do Epstein's operations tell us about the capitalist world of billionaire elites? Joining us to help answer that question is Jeet Heer. He's a national affairs correspondent for The Nation and host of the weekly Nation podcast, The Time of Monsters. He also pens the monthly column Morbid Symptoms, and he's written a couple of stories about the Epstein files, the latest one, From Epstein to Bezos, The Ruling Class is Rotten to the Core. His earlier article was called Jeffrey Epstein Was a Warlord, We Have to Talk About It. Welcome to the program, Jeet.
Great to be on.
Let's first talk, before we get to the warlord aspect of it, let's talk about what the Epstein files say about the social networking that it seems as though the wealthy of the world are involved in behind closed doors. This sordid story unveils, of course, not only the way in which women and girls have been victimized and offered up as you know, just objects for mostly men to enjoy, but it's also, doesn't it also reveal the way in which often these connections were built on trading favors, much of it after Epstein was already convicted, was already in the sights of federal investigators.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the most horrifying part is the sexual predation of children, which, you know, Epstein and his associate Ghislaine Maxwell participated in. And which, I mean, there's considerable evidence to believe that they were involved with sort of trafficking. And one of the interesting things is that the only Epstein and Maxwell were like ever charged with this, even though it seems to go far. I mean, like, the way I would put it is, like, if you're accusing someone of being, if you're convicting someone, as you did with Maxwell, of being a trafficker, then they must have had clients. But the Department of Justice position seems to be that trafficking happened, but only among the you had pimps without johns,
which is often the case in the way in which smaller level sex work is criminalized. Right? We often criminalize sex workers, but not their supposed clients.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But that's actually honestly, like, that is the position of Epstein's lawyer, Alan Dershowitz. He has actually specifically stated that he thinks the sex workers should be charged, but not the Johns, and which is you know, an interesting perspective. But beyond the, you know, sexual crimes, which are the kind of like those are, I think, one of the pillars of Epstein's sort of social network, and I think he trafficked in women partially to gain the sort of favor and access. But he went far beyond that. He, you know, there's a lot
and
of people.
And just to pause there, I want to pick up on what you said. It seems as though, and I'm speculating here, it seems as though he was able to offer wealthy people the kind of thing that they couldn't get legally or access legally outside or, you know, in real life, right? It's sort of like the drug dealer, the most inaccessible, the most, you know, the most desirable drug being vulnerable people that you mm-hmm. can exploit without fearing criminalization. And so, which often rape and sexual assault is about the power, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. That was partially one of the things he was dealing with, but I think it's pretty clear that that's not the only thing he was dealing in, that he like was often setting up. I mean, he was a social networker. You know, there are people out there whose like main thing is that they can connect people. They can throw parties or hold events where different people can come together and, you know, form partnerships. A kind of like sort of like a social matchmaker, if you will. And we see this like at many points with stuff not involving the sexual trade, but like involving business deals, and particularly involving the sort of military-industrial complex. So I think one thing is that there's this like tape of Epstein talking to the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who'd also been Defense Minister of Israel, and telling him about Peter Thiel, and actually spelling out Thiel's name and incorrectly spelling out the name of Palantir, Peter Thiel's company, and saying that, you know, Barak should get to meet Thiel. And which happened, and that, you know, like there was a business arrangement that formed between Palantir and Ehud Barak's company. Ehud Barak, you know, having access to all this sort of Israeli military intelligence, Palantir having surveillance technology that would be of interest to Israel. But then also because Israel is the sort of, you know, uses the Palestinians as a laboratory for research and development of weapons, these technologies were then sold to other countries in Asia and Africa. And so in that case, you can kind of see that what Epstein was doing was working as a connector. And he would often, you know, he was in business partnership with Barak and, you know, would kind of get a kickback that way. And that was really the sort of source of his wealth. And it extended, he had several powerful social networks. One is in Silicon Valley, So he was like hanging out, and this is all after his conviction in 2008 for child sexual trafficking. I had connections with people like Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel. So these are the Silicon Valley people. He also had this other network of New York financial people in the sort of banking world, another network of people in European politics, with some of which is now causing huge controversy with Peter Mandelson, who's a big sort of fixer within the Labour Party, and which might actually like lead to the current Prime Minister resigning. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about this, and certainly there've been resignations in the Labour Party, and extending to the sort of European world, and also extending particularly to like oligarchs in Russia and oligarchs in the among the Arab autocracies, a lot of ties with the sort of silicon, with the sort of monarchical figures, royal figures in places like United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and as well as through his friendship with Ehud Barak and other people, including like Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who went to Epstein Island, really close ties with the Israeli national security state. And to see the sort of larger impact, I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, one of the big things with sort of a bipartisan foreign policy is this idea of an Abraham Accord, of the United States of working to broker a deal between the Arab autocracies and Israel. And one sees the Arab Accord in embryo in the Epstein files. Epstein is already friends with everyone who's a party of this, and he's like trying to like arrange this because it's very financially beneficial for people to put aside ideology. And honestly, like I don't think I while the great mass of people in the Middle East are very concerned about the Palestinians and human rights, the elites in the Arab countries are not. And so a deal where you know Israel could provide security surveillance technology to regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirate, Qatar, which needed to surveil their own people because they're dictatorships. So Epstein was really like a, you know, like a major power player in setting all this up.
Right. One of the things that you point out, that you just pointed out, and also in your piece, you point out, is so important for us on the outside here, looking in on this, to conclude that ideological differences between billionaires are really quite fickle, because in the end, they are united by capitalism. They're united by their thirst for power and profit. And it's very easy for them to set aside those differences because those differences don't actually matter. It seems to matter to us that there are these two camps because it feels good to think, well, there's the conservatives and the liberals. But actually, when it comes to money, the people who have it are often united against the rest of us, right?
No, I mean, he clearly had friends with, you know, obviously he's friends with two American presidents, Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, and had people like Steve Bannon, but also a lot of, you know, like Larry Summers, who had been like federal Treasury Secretary under
For
Clinton
Obama,
and under
right.
Obama. So you know, like
And also
it's,
Noam
I mean, I
Chomsky. I
do think it
mean,
is,
we need to
you know,
bring
the
that
idea is
up
an
too. He
ideology, it's
was
an ideology of wealth.
right.
That is the commonality.
Yeah, I mean, he was also friends with Noam Chomsky, which I think the left is grappling with right now. And let's actually take a minute to even discuss that. I don't know if you have any opinions on that. I know you mentioned it
Well,
in one
yeah,
of
I
your
mean, the Chomsky
stories.
thing is kind of interesting because he was both partially using Chomsky as a kind of bait to bring in other people because he liked to have sort of like intellectuals and Harvard and MIT scientists and people aboard. I mean, the Chomsky story is, as far as I can figure out, there's a very sad personal element, which is that Chomsky's had been married for a long time, for you know, roughly 60 years. His first wife died of cancer. There had been a trust that was in her name because they had thought that she would outlive Chomsky. And then Chomsky had all sorts of financial issues with his children. And Epstein kind of stepped in and, you know, like offered financial advice because Epstein was a fixer. And in an almost a ridiculous way, I mean, there's a letter from the Princess of Norway. You know, she wanted like someone to provide her with dental cleaning services, and she went to Epstein, and he set her up with his dentist. Literally, so Epstein was a fixer, was able to bring in Chomsky in that way, and I think Chomsky was also partially attracted to the idea that Epstein was friends with Barack, and Chomsky had a lot of questions about the Oslo Accord, which Barack was a major part of, and you know,
Ehud
like
Barak,
Chomsky was
just to
kind of like
clarify.
seduced into that world. But it was almost used as a kind of devil's advocate or court jester of this, like, because otherwise, aside from Chomsky, like, the overwhelmingly, like, the consensus of the people around Epstein was like a sort of like a strongly pro-Zionist, pro-American imperialism. You know, like, if one talks about ideology, I think, like, in the 90s, he might have been a typical sort of Bill Clinton globalist. But after 2008, like Silicon Valley itself, Epstein was radicalized into a more radical idea that, you know, you need chaos to spread, to create business opportunities.
And in fact, yes, tell me about that exchange, which you point out in your story, where he's so, you know, when such emails are exchanged between power players and they, you know, don't think anyone's watching, they become really honest about how they like to take advantage of political chaos to make money. And Epstein was very open about that, right?
Yeah. So I'll just roughly summarize it. So Epstein wrote, Brexit is just the beginning. Thiel said, beginning of what? And Epstein says, you know, rise of tribalism, retreat from globalization. You and I have talked about how even negative interest rates are not enough. There's more business opportunities when things are falling apart. And it's important, you know, like after the 2008, there was negative interest rates, which basically meant the wealthy got free money from the government. But from the point of view of Epstein and Thiel, that was not actually enough. That you, in a new environment, what you needed was a chaotic world where a lot of normally successful businesses would fall apart. And then you, if you had wealth, as Epstein and Thiel did, you could come in and buy them at a bargain. And that was a deliberate strategy. I mean, it is something that, you know, Naomi Klein has written about as the shock doctrine. But it's very fascinating. And there's a lot of that in Epstein's emails. He often talks about this idea of, you know, creating shock and chaos. That is actually the explicit ideology of this this group in the ruling class.
Right. And I just want to briefly go back to Chomsky just to say to my audience that I find Chomsky's involvement in Epstein's world utterly inexcusable, and I don't buy any of the excuses that a lot, unfortunately, of people on the left have made for him. He should have known better. It's really shocking that he, you know, said the kinds of things that he did, and absolutely none of it is excusable, because again, all of this was after it came out that he was a convicted sexual predator and trafficker.
And also, I mean, I think even worse, like, you know, Chomsky did not take the accusations seriously and was, you know, acting like this was like, you know, a case of, you know, what people call, like, you know, like woke out of control or whatever. That's a very serious failing. I will contrast Chomsky's behavior with Norman Finkelstein, who is a friend of Chomsky, also a very strong critic of Israel. And Norman Finkelstein was also invited to this, and he basically wrote back, you know, a screenshot of, like, of some of what Epstein's crimes were, and saying, you know, like, I would meet you only to, like, strangle you. So I mean, there was definitely a different path that was taken, and Chomsky did not take that.
Yeah. So let's talk about the way in which Epstein was also involved in global politics in terms of fomenting wars, encouraging wars. You refer to him as a warlord. And that's something that the media has not really, the commercial media, the mainstream media has not really picked up on as much. I mean, we alluded to it a little bit. You said that it was clear that he had some ties to Israeli security apparatus. Some people have said, well, he was a, you know, Israeli government asset. I'm not sure that that's really open. But haven't some independent media outlets?
I think it's wrong to sort of see him as a Mossad asset, as some people have said. That's almost an old-fashioned way of thinking about things, thinking that what's driving things are intelligence agencies, and they have these clients that carry out their things. I think what has happened with sort of neoliberal globalization is that the sort of intelligence agencies and government security states now work for the billionaires. And Epstein and others were sort of like independent, wealthy actors who did on occasion collaborate with the intelligence agencies. And I think particularly he was in business with Ehud Barak. They had a business partnership together, and the idea was to take Israeli surveillance technology, where, you know, developed in Gaza and the West Bank, because these places are laboratories for the development of, like, you know, horrific weapons and systems of oppression and selling them. And in his exchange with Ehud Barak, he, you know, Epstein mentioned, like, you know, Syria, Ukraine, Sudan, you know, these all present like great opportunities. And Barak responded, "I agree, but we have to figure out how to monetize." And then the monetization that Epstein says in the sort of like in another exchange is, well, you know, a lot of elites are going to be very scared. The more chaotic the world is, the more we opportunities we have. And he also had a similar exchange with a banker where he said, you know, in Ukraine, when the civil unrest happened in 2014, he's, you know, just like there's a lot of opportunity here. So this is someone who's like a sort of vulture or a scavenger. He's seeing the chaos in the world, and he's seeing that there are business opportunities to be had, especially if you have close ties with intelligence and defense industries.
Right. Well, Jeet, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll certainly link to both of your stories in The Nation magazine about the Epstein files. And remain to be seen if anybody actually faces consequences, particularly among the elites, for their roles in this sordid mess. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure to talk.
My guest has been Jeet Heer, national affairs correspondent for The Nation and host of the weekly Nation podcast, The Time of Monsters. He also pens the monthly column, Morbid Symptoms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. In one of the largest mass firings of any media outlet in history, the Washington Post recently laid off hundreds of employees, or nearly a third of its entire workforce. Owned by one of the world's richest men, Jeff Bezos, the paper has lost a huge number of subscribers, in large part because of the 2024 decision by Bezos to end presidential endorsements. The paper's publisher, Will Lewis, justified the firings, saying, quote, "Difficult decisions have been taken in order to ensure the sustainable future of the Post so it can, for many years ahead, publish high-quality, nonpartisan news." Lewis then announced his own resignation, in which he thanked Bezos, saying, quote, "The institution could not have a better owner." What does the Washington Post's decimation mean for an already fractured news industry? Joining me to help answer that question is Victor Picard, professor of media policy and political economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. He's authored several books, including Democracy Without Journalism and America's Battle for Media Democracy. Welcome to the program, Victor.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
First, let's talk about why the Washington Post had been failing, because that's the big question at the heart of the decisions that its own new owner claims he's taking. He's saying that he's simply using data to justify how to fix the outlet. But the fact is that it had been losing a lot of subscribers. Now, I pointed out that 2024 decision to not endorse presidential candidates may have had a lot to do with it. And indeed, it was documented that hundreds of thousands of people did end their subscriptions. Is it a lack of subscriptions that you think has led to this?
Well, that's certainly a contributing factor. And I think there are at least two general narratives here that we could point to try to make sense of what just happened to the Washington Post. One is, as you already suggested, that there's been a series of mismanagement moves, you might call them, in over the last year or so, where not only has there been a kind of exodus of subscribers, right? NPR reported that after that decision to spike the endorsement for Kamala Harris, they lost 250,000 subscribers. That was a major blow to their subscription base. And then there have been other moves, such as the shift to the right of their editorial pages, where they've been instructed to focus on personal liberties and free markets. So there's been all this meddling from above into the Washington Post's news production, which isn't supposed to happen. But I'd say even beyond this kind of mismanagement would be these deeper systemic problems that are afflicting the entire newspaper industry. And I'm sure your viewers and listeners have heard bits and pieces of this, but it really is a structural problem where local journalism in particular is collapsing. So it is true that Jeff Bezos was losing roughly $100 million a year on the Washington Post in recent years. And again, this is something that's deeply systemic. But beyond that, this is also a story of bad billionaires. I think this finally puts to rest this notion that benevolent billionaires are going to swoop in and save journalism. So it's both these kinds of narratives that I think we need to talk about. The one about the bad ownership, I think, is getting more attention, but it certainly has these overlapping aspects with these systemic problems as well.
I mean, I think it's important to try to tease some of these things apart. On the one hand, the Washington Post is under Bezos, started to go rightward. And it wasn't, I think, as much as people being upset that their favorite candidate didn't get endorsed as much as it was that in the face of, at a moment when the United States was on the potential verge of electing, an authoritarian who would push it over the edge into full-blown fascism, that a newspaper chose that moment to not take a stand is, I think, what really upset people, and less so that it was just a bunch of pro-Kamala Harris people who were upset. So that decision to tilt rightward was a very deliberate decision. But if that's what fed the paper's inability to retain readership, It is disingenuous, is it not, for Bezos to say, well, we're making these decisions based solely on data so that we can produce, quote unquote, nonpartisan news. And this kind of ideology, this approach that, well, we're just going to have balanced news. We're not going to have it tilted in favor of liberals because that's what journalism is. All of this is disingenuous, is it not?
Oh, absolutely right. You're spot on. I think that context is absolutely key to understand what happened. And you're right to point out that that decision to not run the endorsement happened just barely a week before, just 9 days or so before the election. And it was also, pretty clearly calculated based on this political calculus that, Jeff Bezos is concerned about his relationship to the Trump administration. So not only is Jeff Bezos the owner of Amazon, but he also owns this aerospace company called Blue Origin, which has a number of government contracts, multi-billions dollars worth of contracts with the federal government. So he has all these conflicts of interest in which, it's understandable, according to his own class interests, that he doesn't want to run afoul of the Trump administration. And so, for these reasons and more, I think there were legitimate concerns about, the coverage that Washington Post was providing its readers, and it's understandable that they were losing, they were hemorrhaging readers. So certainly this is a major blow to their business model. They're losing this revenue stream, but it's clear that this isn't just about money. This is also about political influence. And so you're absolutely right to suggest this was the standard, the official narrative that they're offering people about why they made these horrific cuts just doesn't pass the smell test. And then one other key part of this broader context is that Jeff Bezos, this is basically pocket change for him. You know, this is money. He just spent $75 million for the Melania documentary. He's throwing money around left and right. When he purchased Washington Post in 2013 for $250 million, that was less than half of what he paid for his super yacht. So he certainly can't afford these losses. And if you really cared about democracy, I mean, that's the horrible irony here, this idea of democracy dies in darkness, then he could clearly weather these losses. But this is just an excuse, in my opinion, to cut down on maybe money that he doesn't want to lose. But more importantly, he's trying to curry favor with the Trump administration.
Now, there's also the issue of automation, right? Will Lewis, the publisher, who was brought on in 2023 to try to make it a profitable venture, which you and I are going to talk about that aspect of it, because that's key to this. I think turned over all the comment sections to artificial intelligence, to AI, and now Bezos and others are saying, well, and others at the Washington Post are saying, data tells us what's valuable and where to focus. We're going to focus on what the data is telling us about audiences, and we're going to let that determine how we figure out the next steps for the paper. The sense that, you know, we're running this based on machine technology. We're not ideological. We're just going purely by the numbers. We're going to be scientific about it. Is the implication? What does that even mean? That data tells us what's valuable and where to focus.
You know, I honestly couldn't tell you for sure because they're not very transparent about these analytics. So we don't even know exactly what data they're looking at and how.
I mean,
they're
but
arriving.
That's clickbait, right? Like, data is clickbait. Data is look, this particular sordid thing that makes people angry gets a lot of hits. So we'll just lift up more of that kind of coverage. That is a data-driven response to any kind, to social media. They're going to apply that to journalism?
Yeah, it's certainly not the ideal way of evaluating journalism. Certainly we should be privileging democratic needs over any kind of profit imperative. And if they're really basing the data on clicks and other kinds of metrics, that really doesn't give us a very good picture of what, not only what people want, but what people actually need. And it's sort of, you know, gamifies and drives journalism in particular ways that's actually quite detrimental to democracy. It tends to encourage, trivial and sensationalized stories. It's often more about what advertisers want than what the people of this democratic society want and need. So it's certainly a very skewed way to set up any sort of media production system. And unfortunately, that's where much of our media has been heading for a number of years now, especially as the advertising revenue model for supporting journalism continues to collapse.
So let's talk about how journalism as an industry that's meant to be profitable is in large part what has ended up, what has led us to this moment, right? We have thousands and thousands of out-of-work journalists, many of whom were working at commercial media outlets, being made redundant because the bottom line doesn't enable their media outlet to continue paying them. And this idea that journalism should be profitable feels like it's reached its kind of natural and predictable conclusion. Out of its ashes, can there be a moment to rebuild journalism in a new way? I know you think about these issues a lot. So, you know, not to make it a sort of like, ooh, let's take advantage of the desperation and the despair of those people who are laid off. But is there a silver lining here? What can come from this?
I think there is a silver lining. Of course, the cliche that every crisis is an opportunity might be something, or at least comes to mind with this situation. I mean, we've been seeing the entire newspaper industry, nosedive for decades now. We've lost 75% of our newspaper journalists, 40% of our newspapers since the early 2000s. And it'd be one thing if that journalism was being, you know, replaced elsewhere, but it's not. When we lose the newspaper industry, we're basically losing local journalism. So we have to find some kind of replacement. And there have been various experiments. And I think here you sort of have a two-pronged approach. One is to try to save what still exists, which is less and less by the day. But certainly looking at these big legacy newspapers like the Washington Post, we can think of, you know, transitioning to a nonprofit or even a low-profit model. You've got the Salt Lake Tribune, which converted to a nonprofit newspaper here in Philadelphia. You've got the Philadelphia Inquirer, which became a public benefit corporation. In Baltimore, you have the Banner, which rose up to, you know, basically provide some competition to the Baltimore Sun, which has been taken over by a right-wing owner. So we do have these kind of, you know, proofs of concept of where, you know, these kinds of models we can point to where there are structural alternatives, but that's not going to deal with the news deserts problem, right? Where tens of millions of Americans are living in areas that have little or no access to local news media whatsoever. So we really are going to have to create something from the ground up, something new. We have some promising things. We're not going to see anything on the federal level for, you know, at least the next few years during the Trump administration. But at the state and local level, we've been seeing some initiatives there. We have one exemplary model in New Jersey, the Civic Information Consortium, which has been successfully operating for a number of years now, where the state government allocates millions of dollars every year to local journalistic initiatives. You have a similar model being proposed here in Pennsylvania. It was just recently passed out of committee and is going to be voted on by the state legislature, where they would create a Pennsylvania Civic Information Consortium. There are all kinds of experiments in states across the country where they're finding creative ways to allocate even millions of dollars to local journalism, the kinds of journalism that the market will no longer support. If we all finally reach this conclusion that there really isn't a commercial future for a lot of the types of journalism that democracy requires, then we're going to have to do more and more of these kinds of non-market-based experiments. And I am hopeful that we'll see more of that in the years ahead. It's just a question always, how bad will things need to get first before we start to see some real structural reform?
Right. And then finally, the ideal scenario, say we lived in a country where there was no federal legislative gridlock and you had the opportunity to design a system from the ground up. It would seem that in a country, especially like the United States, where there is so much wealth floating around, where we tend to spend all sorts of money on the worst possible things that don't make us safer, healthier, happy, that we could collectively choose to set aside a fund for publicly funded media where strings-free funding is available for nonprofit organizations to demonstrate that the news and, you know, that supporting a healthy democracy through real journalism is the way to go. I mean, other countries often have had that quite successfully, right? I mean, sure, there's been problems with state-funded media and the media coming into control of authoritarian states, but then there are lots of other examples where you have a free media that is funded by the state and that the state can't interfere in, right?
I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, while we need to do these more immediate experimental initiatives and interventions, for the long term, what needs to be on our political horizon is a massive publicly funded media system that's actually owned and controlled. It's not just public in name, but it's actually owned and controlled by the public, by local communities that determine, you know, what kind of media, what kind of issues get covered in their own media so that they can tell their own stories. And so, you know, I've advocated elsewhere for what I refer to as a public media center, which is something that I'd like to see federally guaranteed, but again, locally owned and controlled and governed in every community across the country. That's going to take tens of billions of dollars a year to support, but that's something that we're throwing money at all kinds. If we just take ICE's budget and put towards public media, we could have the BBC on steroids. You know, a radically democratic BBC model would be something that I think we should strive for. And I don't think that's, you know, wildly utopian. In fact, I think that's our last best hope to provide the local journalism that democracy requires.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Victor, for joining us today. Really appreciate your insight on this. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali. Always great to talk to you.
My guest has been Victor Picard, a professor of media policy and political economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The Trump administration has imposed federal immigration enforcement agents on states around the nation, including ones where the immigrant population is relatively minuscule. This includes Maine, the whitest state in the nation, where a mere 4% of the population is of immigrant origin. ICE agents have wreaked havoc on the state, and even after Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine requested an end to the operations, tensions remain high and ICE sightings continue. But immigrant rights advocates have adopted the defensive measures that activists around the country have popularized. Joining us now to explain how well it's worked is Ruben Torres. He is the advocacy and policy manager for the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. The coalition serves over 100 member organizations across the state of Maine seeking to improve legal, social, and economic conditions for immigrants in the state of Maine through advocacy, information sharing, and collaboration. Welcome to the program, Ruben.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The language that ICE has been using in states around the country has been as dehumanizing as its actions. And in Maine, they have called their operation Catch of the Day. If there was ever dehumanizing language, literally reducing immigrants to fish being caught, it would be, you know, it would be hard pressed to find anything worse than that. What has so-called Operation Catch of the Day actually played out? What does it look like on the ground?
Yeah, thank you. So Operation Catch of the Day, as it was dubbed by the federal government, started on January 20th in the state of Maine, where we, the Maine Immigrants Rights Coalition and our partners, manage a immigrant defense hotline that has been colloquially known as the ICE Watch Hotline. But through that hotline, we're able to receive calls and monitor situations on the ground from community members to better provide them resources and understand what issues they're facing. Through that hotline, we were able to really get a good understanding of the community needs through conversations with community members themselves directly. We also hosted a lot of community conversations with immigrant community leaders from across the state to understand how this was playing out in their communities. Overall, while the rhetoric claims to have been targeting the worst of the worst and going after criminals, the reality is that we saw something completely different. We saw families being torn apart, grocery stores and places that were considered safe and routine in everyday life have all of a sudden lost that security blanket, and people are fearful and scared of what the world has changed into.
And so the kinds of things that we saw, for example, in Minneapolis, where there were people being grabbed by ICE while in their car, sometimes with their children, people being disappeared very quickly. Did that play out in Maine?
Yeah, the way that the operation played out in Maine was in ways very similar to Minneapolis and other ways very different. We saw some similar tactics in the sense of people being followed to and from healthcare appointments, windows being smashed, and children being left alone in the car crying. People being ripped out of their cars. We saw corrections officers and law enforcement officers be arrested as a part of this operation. So again, we just saw this tactic of initiating fear and confusion among community members. If the goal was to target the worst of the worst, we were seeing the exact opposite happen.
So what you're suggesting is that we have seen that Maine has seen similar tactics to Minneapolis, but not as much of the media attention, it seems. How have the immigrant, how has the immigrant population on the ground actually been impacted? Are people staying in place? Are people fearful of going to school? Because in Minneapolis, we saw a switch to Zoom for school children because parents were terrified of taking their kids to school. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, during the time of the operation, we saw effects in many different ways across sectors. In schools, we were hearing reports of about every one in three students missing school, or about 30% absentee rate among the Southern Maine school systems. That was also reported among the adult school education system at a much higher rate. So we saw overall folks were scared to take their children to school, and children were scared to go to school.
Now, in terms of the people who were impacted, I noticed that Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition did an analysis of the people who have been ensnared by ICE raids, and found that basically a majority were working age men, perceived to be of immigrant origin, and most of them of immigrant origin. Is that, you think, a deliberate tactic to impact the state's economy? And how has it actually impacted the economy?
Yeah, so the report that you're mentioning was a report and analysis that we did looking at Department of Homeland Security data from September 1st, 2023 to October 15th, I believe, 2025. So just before this whole mess of the surge was even in the works,
I see.
potentially. So it really gave us a good picture of what was going on in the state before this whole immigration enforcement conversation came down the pipeline for Maine. In that, yes, we did find that a vast majority of folks that were being arrested were working age men who were people of color from backgrounds that included almost no criminal backgrounds in a vast majority of those cases. And we were able to use that profile to better understand what was happening during the search and to understand what the return to normal operations, as was stated in Senator Collins' statement, might look like. And so for us, that means that we must really work with our community teams and partners who are providing care and services to mothers, newly mothers, newly pregnant mothers, and people who have families and are mothers as well. Because of that profile detailing that the folks who are being impacted are the breadwinners, are the people who culturally bring the stability and head of household to a lot of different cultures. And so with that analysis and with that understanding, we're able to understand that we need to better advocate for the needs of single mothers and mothers who have all of a sudden entered that role of head of household and caretaker, where traditionally they may not have had that role.
Now, I understand also a majority of those, or a significant fraction of those apprehended, were African immigrants. It's not something we hear that much about from nations like Angola, right?
Yeah, so Maine is a very interesting state in wherein our immigrant population tends to be very different from the rest of the country. The mass majority of our immigrant population tends to be asylum seekers or people who are seeking asylum from their home country in our state. And the vast majority of those folks actually come from sub-Saharan Africa. So you're looking at Angola, Rwanda, Sudan, South Sudan, Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and those countries down south. That's where a vast majority of the folks who make up the immigrant population of Maine are. It's not all, the immigrants in Maine. We have a diverse population of immigrants in our state from the Khmer community, Vietnamese, Filipino, Hispanic, Ecuadorian, Mexican. So you really get all branches of immigrants making up our state. But the vast majority are asylum seeking from that sub-Saharan African region.
So, how have people been standing up to ICE terror? Let's talk about the response. You mentioned there's the rapid response line, the hotline that your coalition shared with folks. First of all, how was that line used, and how did it actually help keep people safe?
Yeah, so we initially started the hotline in collaboration with the People's Coalition on Justice and Safety, which has other organizations that are also part of the MERC membership and others that orbit the MERC membership and work that we do. We started that line back in October because of the recent funding of HR1, which included a massive amount of money for immigration, customs, and enforcement. And so, because of that, we were seeing a lot of folks with confusing and misrepresenting reports on the ground of what they were seeing, fearing that it might be ICE or ICE agents in a given location, and not knowing about the relative safety about whether or not to go to an area. Because of that, we decided to work with our partners to found and establish this hotline to be able to work with that misinformation. And instead of having misinformation running around our communities and spreading fear, provide a place where people can call and either we can verify sightings or allow people to know that it is safe to go to an area, because ultimately the suspicious looking car in that area was actually just a rail car vehicle, or it's actually local police doing a traffic stop. So you start to be able to quash the misinformation that's spreading throughout the communities. And that was ultimately our goal, was to be able to make sure that people were able to make their own security assessments based on the information available.
And then you also had Know Your Rights trainings for folks to be able to understand what to do in the event of ICE agents apprehending them.
Yeah, so we partner with a couple of member organizations like the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, or ILAP, and the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, to be able to host and share Know Your Rights materials and information that came from a trusted legal source to go into communities. We were also working to translate a lot of those materials into other languages, so that way they would be available for folks in their mother tongue. We've also worked to make sure that our resource hub, where you can find those resources and Know Your Rights information, also contains information in ASL, or American Sign Language, for folks that may not that may be deaf or hard of hearing and need some better representation there.
Were there instances where there were confrontations? And I'm actually specifically wondering about non-immigrant solidarity. One of the most inspiring things that came out of Minneapolis was to see how the non-immigrant community were, sort of done with seeing their neighbors being terrorized and showed up. And in fact, two people got killed for doing so. Did something similar play out in Maine, a state where the vast majority of residents are white?
I think the interesting thing about how the situation played out in Maine was that you really saw in full force the effect of our community. Community is a strong and powerful word here in Maine, because it carries a lot of connotations about your neighbors, about who the people around you are. And that community sense is extremely strong because of our geographic makeup. So we're very spread out and rural, and a lot of times your neighbor and your community is all you have to rely on. Because of that, what we saw was Portland and other cities around and towns around the state come out together in protest in support of their immigrant community members during the blackout of businesses that happened a week ago or a couple of weeks ago. A number of businesses around the state chose to either shut their doors or provide a portion of their revenue from that day to local organizations that were doing a lot of work in the community and supporting immigrant neighbors. Donations ranged from 20% to one business that I saw that was donating 100% of the revenue. So we saw a lot of businesses step up and try to support community.
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We're taking your pledges for Rising Up with Sonali Kohatkar. 818-985-5735. If you appreciate the content that she is bringing us and telling us about what's going on, if you enjoy her guests, enjoy what she does, call now and pledge your support. If you appreciate the investigative reporting that she's offering here each and every Tuesday at 3 o'clock, call us now at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We are in our fund drive. We're in our last couple of days, few days. We're winding it down. It's almost over. And thanks to you, we've almost reached our goal. We're trying to get that goal that we have. We're trying to reach that goal that we set for this program. It's a $1,000 goal for this program, and we're trying our hardest to make up. We are really behind right now. We don't want to extend the fund drive. We don't want to come back with more pitches, more pledging. Hey, we just want to ask you to go to your phone now and pledge your support at any amount, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or pledge securely online at kpfk.org. But where do your funds go? They go to the transmitter. They go to the air conditioner to keep the equipment clean, to keep the equipment cool, and that way it doesn't overheat. 818-985-5735. We have mostly volunteers here at the station. Hardly nobody gets paid, but it's a labor of love that we continue and keep this radio station on the air as a community, as volunteers. We got to keep this station going because really it's all I got. It's all we got during this time where Trump administration is cutting funds. But, you know, if the Trump administration, if we depended on them for those funds, we would be out of business right now. So, na 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 na, we do have listener sponsors, listeners like you that keep us on and on the air, that keep us on the air and keep us vital. 818-985-5735. You turn to KPFK for your breaking news. You turn to KPFK to find out what we are going to say next about what happened the day before. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We're just about out of time, so please, folks, pledge for KPFK, pledge for Rising Up, pledge for Global Village. Earlier today that we heard Peggy Lee's Greatest Hits. You can call the phone room now and say, hey, I want that Peggy Lee Greatest Hits, but I want to credit it towards Global Village, in which we can bring you that rare, never hardly played music from Peggy Lee. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.